It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Supreme Court started a new term last week. The justices will decide cases on campaign finance, abortion, and affirmative action. Pitt Law Professor David Harris joins us to discuss the court and how they could rule on these issues and more. David Harris, good to have you back with us.
Paul, good to be with you as always.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. You can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. So, David, what's the term going to look like?
Well, we won't have the kind of blockbuster cases that ended the last two terms, gay marriage and then before that Obamacare. What we're going to have is a revisiting of many of the recent and even not so recent precedents that define the era in which Justice O'Connor sat at the middle of the court. She was sort of the moderating voice between conservatives and liberals. And many of her decisions and opinions are going to be, I would predict, reversed by the court. The court seems bent on revisiting things about campaign finance, abortion rights, free speech, all sorts of things from her era and even from before. So what we're going to see as the dominant theme here is a court going back to decided cases, decided law, and changing course, shifting things to the right.
Re-examining issues that have been regarded as settled for a long time.
Yes, many of them have. That's right.
Well, a campaign finance might be the biggest case of all. It's certainly one that they've already taken it up, and there's been no ruling yet. But it was something that back in 2011, when it first came up and we had the infamous Citizens United decision, the president wasn't happy. A lot of citizens were up in arms. The court is considering removal of overall contribution limits to add to changes that came with the Citizens United decision in 2011. And these are rules that have stood since Watergate. So at issue here, the question seems to be, does money spent on political campaigns fall under free speech protections for the First Amendment? Is that really what's at the heart of this issue?
That's really what it is. And it's been very clear that Justice Roberts feels that this is something he needs to fix. The Citizens United case was the first big salvo in what's going to be a sort of multi-shot war, if you will. And this case takes the Citizens United idea one step further. Now, not only do we have unlimited campaign contributions by entities, this case this year will look at the overall campaign spending limits. There are limits on how much you can give any one candidate, I think $2,300 a person. And then there's an overall limit on how much you can give to a whole bunch of candidates, $2,300 at a time. It's $123,000, if I'm remembering correctly. And this has been challenged on the basis of free speech, that people should be able to give, if they have the money, all the money they want to all the candidates they want. And I'd predict that this rule, which has stood since Watergate and was affirmed in a case called Buckley versus Valeo in 1976, this rule will fall. We'll have another opening of the campaign system to more money.
So people can give, and what will that mean? People can give as much as they want to the candidate of their choice?
No, we're not there yet. I think that will be the next step. What this
really?
Will mean, yes, I'm certain of it.
Astounding.
Yes, all of these campaign limits that came up in the Watergate era as a way of reducing the influence of money on politics are being tested, and this Supreme Court seems inclined to throw them all out. This particular case will mean that any one wealthy person can give as much to as many candidates or to parties as he or she wants, as long as it's in $2,300 increments. It will remove the overall campaign limit on how much money you can put in, but not the individual contribution limit. That will be next.
Okay, but for now, you can, the limit is $2,300, but you can give infinite numbers of contributions?
You can give numbers of contributions until they add up to that magic top number of about $123,000. And that's what's at stake in this case.
And then that limit could go.
That limit is going to go. You heard it here first.
Okay. And Judge Roberts is going to cast the deciding vote.
Well, he's going to be the leader on it.
A crucial vote.
Right. There are five votes right now. We saw it in Citizens United. We saw it at the argument in the Supreme Court last week to overturn these kind of campaign limits.
Yeah, it's got. How would you characterize? It's one of the fun things about listening to the way NPR covers the Supreme Court. Nina Totenberg quotes from those.
She's the greatest.
She quotes from those transcripts, and if you look at the transcripts from the discussions they had, I mean, it got downright nasty.
Yes, it's often very contentious. You have to remember when we talk about the arguments and we read or hear from the transcripts, as Nina Totenberg does, the justices are really talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of their first opportunities to exchange views with each other, and they use the arguments to do that. It isn't really about questioning the lawyers and getting answers from the lawyers. It's about putting statements in the form of questions to persuade each other.
Well, and they get sarcastic. You had Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the justices, saying that it's a free speech issue, but it doesn't necessarily, in this situation, when you're talking about contributions, it's not necessarily a First Amendment issue. And then Justice Scalia, he responded sarcastically, saying that he assumed a law that only prohibits the speech of 2% of the country is okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, they're getting into it there. It's so interesting because the two of them, Scalia and Ginsburg, are known to be very, very close. They share a love of opera, and yet they're on opposite sides of the ideological spectrum and frequently disagree, and sometimes in a very spirited way.
Now, again, and I know we're spending a lot of time on campaign finance, but that's really the juiciest of all the issues here. When you talk about these campaign finance laws that go back to Watergate, why were they created in the first place? And if they're all struck down, where does that leave us, David?
They were created in the first place in the wake of the recognition that money and campaign contributions played a substantial role in the Watergate affair and in the undoing of the Nixon presidency ultimately. And the idea was that if we could limit the influence of money so that people as individuals or as corporations could not overwhelm the political process, it would be more open to everybody. You wouldn't have certain voices, if you want to call money free speech, you wouldn't have certain voices drowning out all the others. But where we're headed is a kind of deregulation of the campaign finance environment to the point where the structure we have been used to seeing for the past 40, 50 years is going to be gone altogether.
And why? Why are we headed that way? Did something somehow change in the last 40 years since Watergate that all of a sudden the influence of money in politics is not a big deal anymore?
No, I would not say that. I would say that we have a Supreme Court majority now that sees money as the equivalent of speech, that speaking in big and loud ways requires lots of money, and to limit campaign contributions means to limit speech. That's how they see it.
President Obama has warned that this case could go even further than what happened 2 years ago with Citizens United. And quoting the president, he says, quote, "It would say anything goes. There are no rules in terms of how to finance campaigns," end quote. Does he have a point?
He has a point in the sense that the rules are being diminished, chopped down, and gotten rid of one good case at a time. There will still be some limits and rules in place, even if the Supreme Court throws these particular rules out. But that's clearly the direction we are heading. That's worth noting that even with Citizens United in the last campaign cycle, it did not make the biggest difference. President Obama was not defeated. He still had passed his health care law. Many candidates on the Democratic side, which was bemoaning Citizens United the most, still made it through the process.
Right.
But it does tend to skew the process long term because there are simply more wealthy donors who favor conservative and Republican candidates and causes. That's a fact. And if there is more money that can come from fewer individuals over the long haul, Republican and conservative candidates and causes will benefit.
Now, in the interest of fairness here, there are conservatives who say, well, you know, the Democrats and the so-called liberals, they get a lot of money from unions. And this wouldn't limit, unions or other liberal philanthropists might want to throw at the Democrats.
That's true. It's true. But it is a fact, as I said, that more wealthy individuals favor Republican and conservative candidates. There's just no getting around that. And over the long run, they are the ones who will make out better in terms of the money they can raise.
If you want to join the conversation with our guest, Pitt Law Professor David Harris, always a good conversation when he shows up, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We're looking at what is on the docket for the Supreme Court, which just started a new term last week. They always reconvene in October. Campaign finance, obviously a big topic of conversation. If you want to comment on that or have questions about some of the other things that we'll hit, including, David, our next issue here, which has to do with abortion. Explain what's going on here.
Well, for years, the Supreme Court has upheld barriers around abortion clinics and people seeking abortions. They have held protesters a certain distance away, in feet, actually, under certain state laws, from heckling or interfering with people going in and out of clinics. And these have been upheld as necessary so that there is not a, quote, undue burden on people seeking the legal services of abortion clinics. A case from Massachusetts is on the court's docket this term attacking one of those various barriers, a 35-foot sort of bubble around people that protesters cannot enter. And again, it's a free speech case. My prediction here is that the court will reverse course and say those sorts of bubbles are no longer constitutional. They interfere with the free speech rights of abortion protesters.
So then how close would an abortion protester be able to get to someone, say, who's going into a clinic to seek advice or perhaps some procedure?
Well, we'll have to wait for the decision to know what room is left for these things. But the court could go as far as saying it's not permissible to screen out any speech in these situations. Nobody can physically interfere with access to abortion clinics, but to ban speech would not be permissible. So the devil will be in the details on this, but I predict those rules that the court had upheld as recently as 2000 will be gone.
There is also a case that the court will be considering regarding affirmative action. And didn't the court just rule on this last year?
That's right. It's only been weeks, actually, months, since the court ruled in the case involving University of Texas at Austin. This case involves the state of Michigan, which was famously involved in the last big affirmative action case in 2003, Grutter versus Bollinger. And in that case, the Supreme Court said race can be a factor in admissions to higher learning institutions as long as it's a very limited factor and certainly not the only factor. Shortly after that, in Michigan, there was a state referendum that put into the state constitution a ban on all racial preferences, not only on college and law school admissions, all racial preferences. And so the question in this case, the one before the court now, is whether a state constitutional provision banning racial preferences is allowed. The argument is, on one side, the people who favor affirmative action say, you're taking us out of the conversation. We're allowed to have racial preferences under the Constitution if we can persuade our legislature and our education institutions to do it. By putting it in the state constitution, you're saying we can't even speak about it. So that's the crux of this issue. Can a state outright ban racial preferences through its own referendum constitutional amendment process?
When might we hear a decision on that?
All of these cases get resolved by the last week in June. Traditionally, what we see is that the harder the case, the longer it waits in the term as the justices behind the scene go back and forth, trade opinions, maybe negotiate, try to gather five votes for a majority.
What about the issue of recess appointments?
Well, recess appointments are allowed by the Constitution. This is a procedure by which a president can make an appointment that would normally require confirmation by the Senate, can make that appointment without that kind of confirmation when the Senate is in recess. That's allowed in the Constitution. And then that appointment only lasts till the end of the congressional term. President Obama has done this in a few cases recently. This case involves appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, which he made, which were very controversial. And the Senate at the time was sort of coming back for a moment every day, going into session and recessing and saying, well, no, 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 we're in session. You can't make a recess appointment. So this will resolve a new practice that has grown up around a longstanding way for presidents from time immemorial to get people into important positions without Senate confirmation.
So it's a new practice based on an old practice.
Yeah, that's sort of it, yes.
Any other possible hot cases that will come during the year that are not yet on the docket?
I would think it's very likely we're going to have a case about whether the police can look inside, look at the contents stored in your smartphone when they seize it or they arrest you. This is a practice of law enforcement almost everywhere, and a few courts have ruled that they actually need a warrant to look within your cell phone and find the information. They can't just do that.
Now, wait a minute. So you're arrested for what?
Anything.
Anything. So let's say the left blinker on your car is out, and which you know they usually pull you over and tell you, hey, did you know that this is out and you need to get that fixed? So while that's happening, they can then say, oh, by the way, can I look at your iPod?
Well, they can always ask, Paul. That's called a consent search. They need no legal basis to ask. What happens in cases like this is when somebody's actually arrested, not just given a summons or a citation, they're taken into custody. The police take their cell phone and just begin doing it without asking. And the question is, can they do that? Open the cell phone and see the vast trove of personal data that's in there.
All of which may be unrelated to the reason that they were arrested.
Chances are, yes. Can they see who you text, who you call, what you say when you text, what websites you visit, all that stuff, should they have to have a warrant to do that?
And what are they looking for? I mean, they're looking through these texts. For example, if somebody gets into an accident and they say they weren't texting, are they looking for evidence that maybe there was a text in there during the timeline when this accident occurred?
Could be. Absolutely could be. We also have Supreme Court rules that allow police to use traffic arrests or other kinds of low-level arrests as pretexts for investigating other things. So if they have an arrestable traffic offense on a person, say a driving while suspended, but they really want the person for, say, a drug investigation – the Supreme Court says as long as you see a legitimate arrestable traffic offense, they can stop your car and they can even put you under arrest. Then they could look in your cell phone and look for evidence in the drug case, even though the stop and the arrest were for something else entirely.
Without a warrant.
Without a warrant in some jurisdictions. Other jurisdictions are requiring warrants. So that's the kind of thing that the Supreme Court would want to look at and resolve. That's why I predict they'll take a case like that and they will probably resolve it.
One last thing that I wanted to hit, and that is a question apparently that the Supreme Court is going to take up regarding whether health plans offer
Yes.
contraceptive coverage. What's going on here?
Well, that's another case that they will probably pick up, but they haven't quite yet. The Obamacare law requires that private employers carry insurance that covers contraception devices of all kinds. And a number of companies, not-for-profit hospitals, have filed suit against this because they say that supplying coverage that gives contraceptive access is against their religious beliefs, and they don't want to have to fund that. So that is almost certain to make its way to the court as a free speech, free exercise of religion sort of issue. I predict that that's going to be on their docket pretty soon.
Yeah, and we've been hearing about these
yes,
concerns.
Yes, in Pittsburgh, that's right.
But I guess I'm not sure how many people knew that the Supreme Court that was ready to take this up.
Well, the cases are in the offing, and the Supreme Court always has the power to decide what it will decide, which cases it will take. But I'd say that one is a pretty likely bet to go their way.
So maybe a more eventful year with the Supreme Court, really, than appeared at first glance.
Yeah, that's right. No blockbusters, but plenty of cases in which they will revisit what we've considered settled law and likely reverse it, bringing the whole structure of the Constitution rightward.
It's fascinating and always good to have you here, David, to walk us through it. Pitt Law Professor David Harris joining us. Thank you again for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Paul.
And thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. And we welcome your comments and story ideas at ESSPGH@WESA.FM. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR news station.